In this book, we have tried to paint a picture of radical changes that are taking place today, aided and abetted by the Internet. But to people who've already lived in the net for a while, these changes aren't perceived as radical at all. They're second nature. On the webpage we asked people to sign in support of the ClueTrain manifesto, one comment was repeated over and over. It's about time. We've talked about the ideas you've just been reading with hundreds and thousands of people online who don't ask for additional explanation. Yeah, they say simply, damn straight. These are people who get it, as the saying goes. They don't need explanations. They already know how it works. But, you may sputter, those are just disgruntled netheads. I read all about them in Time or TV Guide or Sports Illustrated or somewhere. Those unemployable fringe types who never amount to anything anyway. Don't bet on it. Here's a small handful of the radical organizations in which people who signed the manifesto work. Bank of America, Boeing, Capgemini, Cisco, Comcast, Compaq, Computer Sciences Corporation, Dow Jones, EDS, Ericsson, FedEx, Fleet Credit Card Services, Herman Miller, IBM, Intergraph, Kaiser Permanente, Kellogg, Kinko's, KPMG, Levi Strauss & Company, Lucent Technologies, Merck, Microsoft, Morgan Stanley Dean Witter, New York Life Insurance, Novell, Ogilvy Public Relations, Oracle, PeopleSoft, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Qualcomm, Saturn, Sears, SEMA Group, Siemens, Sun Microsystems, U.S. Interactive, the U.S. Internal Revenue Service, U.S. West, U.S. Web CKS, Wang, W.R. Hambrecht & Company, Ziff Davis. Stereotyping is a bitch, ain't it? Clichés are so comfortable and easy. Business is fat cat moguls meeting in posh boardrooms atop steel and glass towers high above the jostling masses in the street. Stereotypes usually have some basis in reality, but they're lousy tools with which to frame critical judgments. More often than not, business happens in the streets, not above them, and so do revolutions. But if you're looking for Molotov cocktails and tear gas, beleaguered cops and firebrand radicals, you're bound to miss what's really happening. Ruth Perkins of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement wrote to us, quote, "Thank you for solidifying the thoughts and mission I've had for so long. I'm a wholehearted signer and practitioner of your manifesto," unquote. Just because you're not seeing a revolution, or what Hollywood has told you a revolution ought to look like, doesn't mean there isn't one going down. The demonic paradox. Although a system may cease to exist in the legal sense or as a structure of power, its values or anti-values, its philosophy, its teachings remain in us. They rule our thinking, our conduct, our attitude to others. The situation is a demonic paradox. We have toppled the system, but we still carry its genes. Ryszard Kapuscinski, Polish journalist, 1991. All talk of revolution notwithstanding, the struggle is already largely over. It's genuinely tough to find anyone who will stand up and defend the standard traditional conventional old-school way in which everyone knows business should be conducted. As far as we can determine, not only does everyone not know it, nobody seems to believe it for a second. This is odd, we think, and critically important to us, personally and professionally. After all, if we're hanging our asses out with this whole ClueTrain tirade, there better be something there to carry on about, right? Otherwise, wouldn't we look stupid? So we rack our brains, we search our souls, we ask ourselves, are we making this stuff up? Is it wishful thinking? Are we maybe just having acid flashbacks? Ever uncertain of our findings, but always wishing to be scientifically precise, we're all constantly performing little sanity checks. Have I slipped the surly bonds of Earth, or is it actually possible that nobody left alive today really believes this stuff anymore? We meet a lot of people in our day-to-day work, a lot of different kinds of people, as random a sample as you could ever hope for. Unbeknownst to them, they are being used as subjects, fodder, if you will, for our ongoing market research. This involves looking for the perfect suit, that is to say, the business person who fully embraces and embodies the corporate stereotype. So far, the closest we've come is some guy in a Dell TV ad, manly but understanding, firm yet gentle with his underlings. Always ready for a good laugh, but no joking around when it comes to delivering the goods. What he really does is hard to tell, though it seems to have a lot to do with his Inspiron brand notebook computer. Man, he takes that baby everywhere. But of course, he's a male model, so we're still looking. Most of the people we run across are rather disappointing in this respect. So, how's the job going? The job? How do you think the job's going? The job sucks. Oh. Or maybe it's someone who just bought a new product online. Are you satisfied with your latest purchase? What, are you yanking my chain? Get away from me, you pervert. Yes, sir. Sorry to have disturbed you. This is hard work, no lie. But we keep at it, relentlessly searching for the canonical business type or the ideal consumer. Neither seems to exist. Isn't that just too weird? But here's something weirder still. If you take someone you've just been talking to in a normal, non-insane sort of way and put him or her in a trade show booth, 9 times out of 10, this person will immediately start talking like a suit. And we are very proud of our preeminent position with respect to our competitors. Dunderhead and Gladhand just ranked our company 2nd in the entire industry, and it makes you want to go out and shoot yourself, or at least take a long hot shower. Then he or she comes off stage and says, "So, how did I do?" You hem and haw. You want to be kind, but how to put it? That was total bullshit. How could you spout that patent crap? I know you don't believe a word of it. Oh, that. Of course not. But how did I do? Mr. Kapuscinski, our Polish journalist from the quote above, says that although we may have toppled the system, we still carry its genes. He says it's a demonic paradox. Jazzman Rasan Roland Kirk has another term for this same phenomenon. He calls it volunteer slavery. So while business stereotypes are largely empty or come from another day and have long since lost any real descriptive power, we find ourselves replicating the behaviors they caricature. Why? Well, because we're business people, of course, and that's how business people behave. Welcome to the Hall of Mirrors. Welcome, as Vonnegut put it, to the monkey house. We don't believe what we're saying at work. We know no one else believes it either, but we keep saying it because the needle's stuck, the record's broken, because we just can't stop, because who would we be if we didn't talk like that? Maybe we'd be free, or freer, at least. In most cases, no one is forcing us to replicate these useless, obsolete behaviors. We imagine we must, but we never investigate. We posit some organizational boogeyman who'd punish us terribly if we were human. Give us a good hard whipping, you betcha. What if there's nobody there, though? What if it's like Santa Claus or flying saucers? Like Fox Mulder, we want to believe. We really do. Maybe it's like, God. Not to be disrespectful, but there's a point here. Historically, capitalism depended heavily on the Calvinist notion that news of impending salvation was telegraphed by worldly success. Worker productivity positively skyrocketed under this inspired setup. It wasn't Santa who knew if you were naughty or nice, it was the big boss, so better knuckle down. But let's get real. A couple of centuries ago, a new invention arrived into the world. It was called the job. The idea was simple, really. You went to some hellhole of a factory, worked 16 hours until you were ready to collapse, and you kept on doing that every day until you died. Cool, huh? You can see where Calvinism must have come in handy. Some people wouldn't do that even for stock options. Among the many casualties of this arrangement was the human spirit, and of its necessary functions, conversation was the first to go. People would talk with each other while doing craft or cottage work, but talk interfered with factory production. And of course there was management. Management knew everything. Workers knew nothing. So shut up and get back to your lathes and looms, you dirty sods. Fast forward 100 years or so, and along comes knowledge work, an even cooler invention that enabled us to have magazines like Fast Company and meant we were allowed to know something all of a sudden. "Excuse us," management said, "but would you mind letting us in on whatever it is, as we're rather tapped out over here?" And the rest, as they say, is history. A history that brings us right up to today with its rip-snorting, high-speed internet with broadband everything, hold the mayo. Whoopee! But that's not the point. The point is what this latest technological wonder brings back into the world, the human story. A story that stretches back into our earliest prehistory. A story that's been in remission for 200 years of industrial progress. When it breaks out again in the 21st century, it's going to make Ebola look like chickenpox. Catch it if you can. And next time you wonder what you're allowed to say at work, online, downtown at the public library, just say whatever the hell you feel like saying. Anyone asks you, tell them it's okay. Tell them you read about it in a book. Put that in your demonic paradox and smoke it. More about radishes. What do I know of man's destiny? I could tell you more about radishes. Samuel Beckett. So what do you think? Will Clutrain be the next big thing? Not if we can help it. Deep Six the bumper stickers. Forget the catchy slogans and the funny hats. Let's not write the bylaws and pretend we did. Let's not start another frickin' club. The only decent thing to do with Clutrain is to bury the sucker now while there's still time, before it begins to smell of management philosophy. Invite the neighbors over, hold a wake, throw a wild and drunken orgy of a party, because only death is static. Life moves on. How do you speak in a human voice? First, you get a life. And corporations just can't do that. Corporations are like Pinocchio or Frankenstein. Their noses grow longer at the oddest moments, or they start breaking things for no good reason. They want to be human, but gosh, they're not. They want the formula for life, but they want it so they can institutionalize it. The problem, of course, is that life is anti-formulaic, anti-institutional. The most fundamental quality of life is something the corporation can never capture, never possess. Life can't be shrink-wrapped, caged, dissected, analyzed, or owned. Life is free. And so finally, the question we've all been waiting for. In the newly humanized and highly vocal global marketplace the Internet has helped create, can corporations survive at all? Not if they're unable to speak for themselves. Not if they're literally dumbfounded by the changes taking place all around them. But maybe, and it's a big maybe, companies can get out of their own way. Maybe they can become much looser associations of free individuals. Maybe they can cut their people enough slack to actually act and sound like people instead of 1950s science fiction robots. Gort need more sales. Gort need make quota. You not buy now? Gort nuke your planet. Easy there, Gort. Calm down, boy. Here, chew on this kryptonite. Everybody's laughing. No one gives a rat's ass. So here's another question. Perhaps you even thought of it yourself. How come this book ended up in the business section of your local bookstore instead of under humor, horror, or true crime? Hey, don't look at us. Fact is, we don't care about business, per se, per diem, au gratin. Given half a chance, we'd burn the whole constellation of obsolete business concepts to the waterline. Cost of sales and bottom lines and profit margins, if you're a company, that's your problem. But if you think of yourself as a company, you've got much bigger worries. We strongly suggest you repeat the following mantra as often as possible until you feel better. I am not a company. I am a human being. So, no, at the end of all this, we don't have a cogent set of recommendations. We don't have a crystal ball we can use to help business plot its future course. We don't have any magic bullet cure for corporate linguistic deficit disorder. Did that much come across? Okay, just checking. However, we do have a vision of what life could be like if we ever make it through the current transition. It's hard for some to imagine the era of total cluelessness coming to a close, but try. Try hard, because only imagination can finally bring the curtain down. Imagine a world where everyone was constantly learning, a world where what you wondered was more interesting than what you knew, and curiosity counted for more than certain knowledge. Imagine a world where what you gave away was more valuable than what you held back, where joy was not a dirty word, where play was not forbidden after your 11th birthday. Imagine a world in which the business of business was to imagine worlds people might actually want to live in someday. Imagine a world created by the people, for the people, not perishing from the earth forever. Yeah, imagine that. Journalism as Conversation by Dan Gilmore. I remember the day I saw the Clutrain manifesto for the first time, because the opening line, "Markets are conversations," gave form to a notion that had been growing in my subconscious for some time by then, and it was a small step to put that idea into words. If markets are conversations, I realized, so is journalism. I'd been involved in that conversation for some time by 1999, largely in my work at the San Jose Mercury News, Silicon Valley's daily newspaper. But my understanding that the online world was all about conversation and collaboration long predated my 1994 arrival in California. In the mid-1980s, having been online for a few years using early bulletin board systems and commercial networks such as CompuServe, I had one of those epiphanies that comes to everyone who eventually recognizes the power of the network. I posed a small programming question to users of a CompuServe forum and got excellent and different answers from a variety of geographies. When I took a job as an editor and then a columnist in San Jose, I discovered something quickly. My readers knew more than I did and were happy, largely via email in those days, to share their knowledge, sometimes in the form of harsh but nonetheless valuable critiques of my work. Long before I had a blog, I was having an online conversation with my readers, and my work was immeasurably better as a result. But Clutrain's appearance, around the time the first blogging software arrived, catalyzed my thinking and changed the way I worked. Not only did it make me understand more clearly how journalism was changing, it also spurred me to push farther and faster into this new world than I'd contemplated earlier. The idea of journalism as conversation inexorably leads to this understanding. The craft is changing for all three major constituencies: the journalists, the people and institutions journalists talk about, and most importantly, the people I call the former audience, who once were mere consumers but who now can, and in many ways need to, play a more active role. Journalists are having to learn new tools and techniques and include the audience in the process. The newsmakers can't hide as easily behind traditional PR or pronouncements. And as consumers become activists, they push the journalists to do a better job and can even become journalists themselves if they choose. The traditional media's long-standing opaqueness and arrogance are well recognized at this point by media customers, including audiences and advertisers. Those qualities mirror the ones that have kept so many businesses from fully understanding the nature of the Clutrain changes. Entertainment media and journalism both rely on scarcity-based business models, but have responded somewhat differently. The entertainment cartel of the past used every arrow in its considerable quiver, first to deny what was happening and then to stop its effects. Going online with big-selling music and movies was seen as inevitable. Understandably, the industry wished to preserve the relationship it had established with artists and the public alike as a middleman with the power to launch, or kill, artists' careers and set mass-market tastes. How did newspapers, magazines, and broadcasters respond to changing conditions? Most embraced the online world to some degree, but few recognized that online could provide more than just a new platform to distribute traditional content. In fact, the word distribute is part of the problem. Media people still tend to think in terms of distribution. We create finished content and send it out, whether in trucks or over the airwaves, a mass, one-to-many approach that worked well in an era of information scarcity. Today, it's not about distribution. Today, we create stuff and make it available. After we make it available, other people come and get it. Certainly, there's an element of distribution, the act of getting our work noticed, but the fundamental nature of consumption has shifted from push to pull, or the modern hybrid that has emerged in the early days of conversational technology. This shift fits perfectly into the Clutrain universe, not just because the people we once called the audience are now part of the process, but also because consumers who become creators also become more savvy in the way they see and understand journalism. Some of the creators become collaborators, leading to a journalistic arena that is essentially unprecedented and, so far, underexplored. My own blog began in the fall of 1999, half a year after the Clutrain Manifesto was posted. I'd been watching the format develop without entirely understanding how it worked. When Dave Weiner, developer of one of the early blog applications, urged me to try one out, I did and was immediately hooked. Blogging is the clearest example of media as conversation. A good blog has an identifiable voice. A human being is talking, not at us, but with us. Blogs subvert the old styles of prose favored by media and companies because of the voice requirement. Real people don't say to each other, "Three people were injured, one seriously, when two cars collided at the corner of Main and Elm Streets." They say, "Did you hear about the crash over on Main Street? It was bloody." Better corporate blogs subvert, thank goodness, the press release style. Read a standard press release out loud. It sounds as though it was written by the mate of a Turing machine and a lawyer. It's an insult to prose and invites cynicism on the part of the reader. When people belittle the small blogs, the ones written for family and friends, they are missing the point about why the genre has grown so rapidly. Surely the value, per reader, of the blog read by a few close friends is vastly higher than the value, again per reader, of the most widely read blog on the web. Random readers may enjoy what they find. friends care. Blogs are part of a larger conversation about ideas and people. We in the blogging world respond to each other via links to the original piece. The hyperlink itself, a critically important part of the conversation, becomes part of a great autonomous machine that we have all created, the back and forth not just of a debate, but our intentions when we share a link with our readers. I was mostly alone as a journalist blogger in the early days, though many people who weren't part of the traditional journalism world were doing work that had a journalistic feel and followed at least some journalistic principles. It took 5 years or more before newspaper blogs became even relatively commonplace. Today, it's a rare paper or broadcast outlet or network that doesn't have a variety of blogs written by staff members. Why people took so long to recognize the value of journo blogging eludes me. It was an absolutely ideal adjunct to my own work as a columnist, a way of trying out new ideas, alerting people to what I was looking into, and in general, inviting my audience to share their own ideas. They had plenty. Over time, I tried to take a somewhat open-source approach to my work. I didn't tell the world prematurely if I had a scoop, though in at least one case we were happy to break it on the web rather than waiting for the newspaper to be published. But I did ask readers to help me figure out whether what I thought I knew was actually correct or whether I'd missed something important. This approach became a key element of my book on the citizen media phenomenon, We the Media. In perhaps my most clue-trainish move, I posted a long outline online and then posted chapter drafts all in the blog. The help I got from readers was extraordinary. Traditional journalism's rapid decline as a business in the past few years has not been the result of bloggers taking away audiences, though some journalistic bloggers have earned serious readerships. The problem is more basic. It's about advertising, about money. Newspapers are trying to move from monopoly positions to a competitive market. Broadcasters are moving from oligopoly to competition. Both are trying to do this in a world where people seeking information and entertainment have vastly more choices than before, and so do the people who have been paying the bulk of the bills, the advertisers. The various revenue streams that have carried the freight for most newspapers in the past half century, notably classified advertising, have been under systematic attack from online competitors. They have won not by being cheaper, though most are, but by doing a vastly better job for both the advertiser and the potential customer. And the best of these enterprises do so in large part by creating communities, not just classified advertising tools. Look at Craigslist.org, the famed site that Craig Newmark began as a mail list in San Francisco for his friends. It is substantially about community. The users of the site, not the employees, are the first line of defense against personal misbehavior and seller scams. Contrast this with the way newspapers have sold advertising for decades. They wait for the phone to ring and then treat advertisers the way monopolists have always treated their customers, with contempt bred from complacency. Customers in a clue-train world don't put up with this. They demand a say in the transaction, and if they can't find a better solution elsewhere, they're free to create their own way of selling. There is little chance that traditional journalism organizations, with a few exceptions, will pull out of their economic tailspin anytime soon. The economic woes that become apparent in 2007-2008 created a nearly perfect storm for the media business. Sadly, there's also insufficient evidence that traditional journalists will break free of their standard ways of doing journalism in time to make a serious difference. The press is a black box into which reporters push interviews and research, and from which emerge articles. Explaining how journalism is created? It happens, but mostly when a news organization screws up so profoundly that it feels compelled to come clean about what it did wrong. Witness the Jason Blair debacle, after which the New York Times published thousands of words describing how it occurred and how it planned to make sure such a thing wouldn't happen again. Bloggers and others in the conversational media field have their own self-correcting system, readers. Not all bloggers correct their mistakes, but the smart ones watch what readers say in the comments and on other sites. The feedback system doesn't always work in a timely way, of course, and some bloggers ignore what they're told even when they're wrong. A promising, if still minor, trend in traditional journalism, online and offline, has been to ask the audience for help doing the reporting. This takes many forms. The Bakersfield, Californian newspaper has asked its readers to fill in a map of the community's street and highway potholes. A newspaper in Florida confronting policy changes in regard to sewer rates, asked readers to help figure out what was going on, and produced investigative journalism that led to changes in those policies. Blogger Joshua Micah Marshall, founder and editor of Talking Points Memo, has won major journalism awards that formerly were the province of print publications. He has repeatedly asked his readers to help gather information for stories. One of the least conversational parts of the newspaper business has been the way publications handle their archives, hide them away behind what Doc Searles aptly calls paywalls, asking for payments when people want to go back into a community's history. This is insane, and in the end, it's an almost completely counterproductive policy. Doc and I, among others, have urged newspapers to put their archives into the public sphere. So far, most have not. One reason is contractual obligations to online libraries, but another is pure myopia. Local newspapers, for practical purposes, archive their community's histories. Certainly there are gaps, but on almost every issue of importance, and when it comes to tracking what prominent local people have done in their lives over recent decades, the newspaper's archives are where you'll find the most comprehensive accounts. On just about any local topic you can name, the newspaper has done stories that would be high in any Google search on that topic. Considering that traffic to those articles would soar if they were visible, it seems likely that newspapers would reap financial gain by making archives more open. One prominent newspaper that has put its archives out in this way is the nation's top publication, the New York Times. It is safe to say that in a decade there will be a Times story link in the first page of any search you make on just about any topic or person of national or international importance, assuming the Times covered the person or issue in its standard depth. The paper's parent company is undergoing plenty of financial stress for other reasons, but its archives are almost certain to be a long-term generator of cash, as well as making the Times the go-to place for vital background on countless topics. That's a web-like way of doing business. Journalism as conversation is the linchpin to the rise of citizen journalism, which takes many more forms than can be described in this short essay. For example, the photo posted by a non-professional from a major event, such as the iPhone camera shot in January 2009, by a man on a New York City ferry boat as it approached a U.S. Airways jet that had ditched in the Hudson River. Place blogs that understand and cover a community too small for traditional media to care about, except when something bad happens. Neighborhood mail lists where people tell each other about things that are genuine news, and so much more. What we create ourselves does not exist in a vacuum. It exists as part of an emerging journalistic ecosystem that I hope will be more diverse and robust. Traditional journalism should and must survive, but it needs the help and the competition from the new players. For professionals and so-called amateurs alike, the tools continue to evolve. A decade ago, not only was blogging new and the notion of journalism as conversation almost inconceivable, but the words podcasting and Twitter hadn't entered the language. Few guessed that millions of people would soon upload videos to the web and then comment on each other's offerings. And in the Web 2.0 era, we combine data and software services from a variety of places with our own ideas and information in a much more interactive way than we contemplated in 1999. Audio and video remain the least conversational of tools, largely because they're linear by nature. Still, entrepreneurs and big companies alike in the field are finding ways to increase the interactive possibilities. Photos have become extraordinarily conversational, however, in part because of services like Flickr, which are all about sharing. The sharing economy, so well explained in books such as Yochai Benkler's The Wealth of Networks and Clay Shirky's Here Comes Everybody, is entirely about conversations. In countless cases, citizen journalists upload their work to the world long before the traditional media are anywhere near the scene. I find myself increasingly intrigued these days by Twitter, which I've called, quote, a current and sometimes early warning and gossip system, with occasional insight and frequent amusement, unquote. Twitter's micro-blogging nature, especially its limit of 140 characters per posting, requires brevity and encourages wit, ideal qualities of a good conversation. The conversation around 140 characters extends, of course, to a medium we'd barely begun to use this way a decade ago, at least in the United States, the mobile phone. People in Japan and Europe, especially the Nordic countries, were already texting each other back then. text has become the primary mode of digital communication in Africa, and we in the developed world are learning from how people use text in places where, so far, they have few other alternatives. In the end, however, the ultimate journalistic tool is the human brain, our ability to learn and absorb and adapt. In a conversational mode, we do all of those more effectively. And what is the first rule of a conversation? To listen. Traditional journalists were poor listeners in the era of monopoly or oligopoly media. But at long last, and in no small part due to the ideas that sparked Kloutrain, they are relearning this vital lesson. Let's hope we're all doing the same. How Lego Caught the Kloutrain by Jake McKee. In the closing pages of the Kloutrain Manifesto, the authors make a point so profound that it can only be described as odd. Quote, "The only decent thing to do with Kloutrain is to bury the sucker now while there's still time, before it begins to smell of management philosophy," unquote. Considering that turning a core idea into a management philosophy is what most business books attempt to do, you can see why I'd use a word like odd. But perhaps this approach wasn't odd at all. Perhaps the reason their book took off is precisely because they chose a more complex and thought-provoking path. In 1999, I read the 95 theses that the authors tacked to the Internet, as they like to say. In 2000, I bought my first copy of the print version of the Kloutrain Manifesto, reading it cover to cover twice in the first week. The points that I had tried to make to my web development clients suddenly had a voice, a vocabulary, a point of reference. But like the Kloutrain authors, I became increasingly nervous as I heard more and more people parroting a line like markets or conversations without fully understanding what it means or how to apply it. It was too easy for marketers to cloak their old business in the new talk without doing anything new or different. But just as we began to see some of these fears begin to play out, I was given a chance to apply the Kloutrain thinking to a company woefully and sadly behind the times, a company everyone knows, that many love, that I had obsessed over for 20 years. I'm talking, of course, about the Lego Company, the toy maker responsible for those iconic plastic building bricks. Founded in 1932 as a wooden toy manufacturer by a Danish carpenter, the company began the path to becoming a global cultural icon in the 1950s with the addition of the plastic Lego brick to their product line. Since then, wooden Lego toys have become a thing of historical record, while today's kids spend upwards of 5 billion hours a year playing with Lego bricks. To understand the Kloutrain story at Lego, you have to understand my personal story as an AFOL, adult fan of Lego. And to understand my story, we first have to travel back in time to the early 1980s. Growing up, my friends aspired to be firemen, policemen, and astronauts. Very cool professions, to be sure. But they were only marginally interesting to me. When adults asked young Jake what he wanted to be, Jake always responded, without hesitation, a Lego designer. For so many of us growing up in those days, Lego wasn't just a toy, but a tool of our imagination, a tangible expression of the visions we had in our head. It wasn't just a big pile of bricks, but a big pile of bricks waiting to be formed into something amazing. The brand promise translated from, "You can build anything," to, "You can be or do anything." After all, if you could make a TIE fighter out of the white rectangular shapes, who could tell you that you couldn't do anything else in life? Whether I realized it at the time or not, this is when I first learned that I didn't buy the brand. I bought what the brand promise helped me imagine I could do. Ironic, considering that 10 years later I find myself leading my own company focused on helping brands activate their promises through conversation marketing. I'm still trying to decide if the Kloutrain authors would be proud of the new company or bothered that I've turned their ideas into management philosophy. By the mid-1990s, the Internet had started to become a powerhouse in pulling together niche groups from all over the country and all over the world. Interests long forgotten could be rediscovered as easily as a web search or an eBay purchase. Adults who had grown up on Lego, many of whom had never really stopped building and playing, started to find each other, sharing pictures of their Lego creations, discussing building techniques, exchanging building elements, and sometimes even meeting offline. Lego's initial brand promise had returned. If you were interested enough in the hobby, a world of opportunity waited for you. I was one of those who began meeting, sharing, and interacting with other LEGO fans from all over the world. If you can imagine the stigma of adults playing with kids' toys, you can also imagine the comfort that came with finding your tribe. And as more and more adult LEGO fans connected, the more they wondered openly and loudly why the company they loved so actively resisted engaging with them. By 2000, when the Clutrain Manifesto first appeared in print, the brand promise that so many AFOLs had grown up believing was now something much more grand. People were realizing that they wanted, needed perhaps, to interact with the companies who were supposed to help deliver on their own brand promises. But LEGO, the company, was far, far removed from this spirit. In fact, it was so far from the core business that when the LEGO staff visited the biggest three customers, Walmart, Target, Toys R Us, in 1999 to talk about the upcoming product line, all three customers independently questioned the lack of understanding LEGO had about the LEGO buyers themselves. Welcome to Fort Business. I joined the LEGO company in late 2000 as part of the LEGO Direct Team, a new division responsible for managing all direct interaction, sales, and marketing efforts that reached the customers, well, directly, an initiative that served as the company's response to its distance from the market. In a company primarily built around distributing product to large, big-box retailers, direct interaction was surprisingly far from the core business, yet it spoke immediately to the spirit of the AFOLs. The LEGO executive team had been aware enough of the shift in consumer expectations to launch a group like LEGO Direct, but the company overall had yet to fully understand, much less embrace, the ideas in Clutrain. The company had for years developed a culture that largely rejected, or at least ignored, outside input. And the company almost exclusively focused around kids, not these weird adult fans. You know, the ones with passion and, money. As an AFOL myself, and as an AFOL who had seen the impact a small group of adult fans can have on large audiences of kids and families, I wanted to see this change. Fortunately, so did my boss and head of LEGO Direct, Brad Justice. Not only was Brad a supporter of the Clutrain, he had specifically designed the business unit around the principles outlined in the book. Brad once told me, quote, "Clutrain was a concise and perfect manifestation in words of something I had been considering for some time, the notion that the ideal enterprise, company or other undertaking, embraced customers and employees equally, that the old paradigm that the company-customer relationship was one of parent to child, you'll eat what I give you, was hopelessly outdated, and technology only accelerated the move away from that paradigm. In fact, it underlay an entirely new form, one of enterprise as vast social network, a real network which was not necessarily the now more rampant virtual ones, where all participants play interdependent roles and all contribute equally to the success of the venture, the growth of the company, the creation of the ideal product, the spread of the brand promise." Unquote. Looking back on it, I had taken to heart lessons from the manifesto that helped change the way this decades-old company approached its adult fans, as well as its entire customer base. It's easy today, with the company fully embracing its community of adults, kids, parents, and families, to look at the 95 theses and map many of them directly to the work our team did inside the company over the years. 52. Paranoia kills conversation. That's its point. But lack of open conversation kills companies. Events and decisions inside a company can seem innocuous at the time, but can lead to hugely detrimental unintended consequences. In the 1980s, LEGO started receiving more and more letters from kids, many of which offered up their own product ideas. This was also the time when lawsuits were being filed at an increasingly, somewhat alarming rate. Whether out of fear of legal threats or actual legal threats, I was never clear on this, the company became legitimately concerned about protecting itself from kids who sent product ideas into the company and then saw their idea on the shelves a short time later. Imagine a kid who wrote in with a great idea like, "I think you should make an underwater theme," only to see it on shelves months later. Keep in mind that it took upwards of 18 months to develop themes at this time. The LEGO legal department issued a directive that the company would no longer accept, quote, "unsolicited product ideas," unquote. A logical, rational, yet eventually damaging directive. The key to this directive was the word "unsolicited," meaning random submissions required active rejection. If you mail in an idea, the directive dictates, LEGO should send it back to you with a thanks but no thanks note. It was that simple. Over time, the specifics of this directive became a bit fuzzy. People lost track of the original intent. By the time the internet and email came around and the quantity of input increased exponentially, the culture at LEGO was already steeped in paranoia. Not only did the company not want to accept incoming communication, but it didn't want to let anything out either. LEGO Direct had to redefine the concept and purpose of secrecy. It's easy, perhaps comforting, to simply lock down everything, not allowing any content, ideas, or discussion to leave the virtual four walls of the company. You can't get in trouble for what you don't say, so why say anything at all? What our team found, though, was that when faced with the question, "Okay, so tell me why that secret," colleagues couldn't answer it, most of the time anyway. Secrecy was comfortable, and we had to pull them out of their comfort zones. That required executive, or at least managerial, support, and we found that it was surprisingly easy to get, assuming, of course, that we had the tenacity to actually ask, something that didn't come easy for far too many of our colleagues. It's hard to argue for comforting secrecy against the potential business gain. We also worked very hard to eliminate the use of non-disclosure agreements, NDA, wherever we could. In theory, these agreements ensure that you are able to share private information with outside partners without fearing that the information will be distributed inappropriately. Knowing that most information isn't really secret, and knowing that NDAs inherently indicate a fundamental lack of trust, we worked hard to protect ourselves in other ways. We found that working with the right people, empowering them to represent the community, and giving them data that made it clear that we trusted them was more useful than any piece of paper. In fact, the perception of trust helped us to create vastly more safe interactions with the outside world, which in turn helped pull the company out of the embedded culture of paranoia it had been rooted in for so long. 60. Markets want to talk to companies. In December 1999, Brad Justice, LEGO Direct's first executive leader, posted an introduction to the adult hobbyist forum, Lugnet. To LEGO enthusiasts everywhere, "We hope that we are the bearer of some holiday cheer for you all. For those of you who have felt that your love for LEGO was unrequited, this is a new day. With this missive, the LEGO company asks to open a dialogue with you, our consumers. Whether you are an AFOL or a parent purchasing a first Duplo set, or a kebab, kid with a bunch of bricks, we just made that up, here are some words that should gladden your hearts. We are listening." This message received more than 200 replies, almost all positive and welcoming. More than 200 replies from a community of, at that time, a few hundred people. It was during this same time that I began my quest to get a job with LEGO Direct, and Brad's message motivated me to believe that the company was porous enough for me to actually get inside. Most Lugnet users were thrilled. After years of ignoring the AFOLs, LEGO had finally wised up and was now engaging the community directly. This sparked incredible new enthusiasm for the company. It also began to legitimize the hobby, reinforcing the idea that maybe it wasn't so weird to play with kids' toys after all, and it planted a flag in the ground saying, "We're listening." After joining the company several months later, I was tasked with meeting as many fan groups as possible. Surprisingly, these first meetings consisted mainly of me listening while the fans complained about the lack of communication from the company in the past decade. But after these initial meetings, the relationship began to find a firm foundation based primarily on the channels that had been opened, first by Brad's note and then by the real action that followed. In the days before blogs and common access into the company, the fact that our team monitored and interacted with fans through forums, emails, IM, and personal phone calls was quite a revolution. But don't get me wrong, the AFOL community wasn't waiting on the LEGO company, far from it. 85. When we have questions, we turn to each other for answers. It may have taken until 2000 for LEGO to participate in the fan community, but by that time the AFOLs had already created a vibrant community ecosystem. By the late 1990s, they had created a photo sharing site, Brickshelf.com, with tens of thousands of LEGO-themed photos posted, an incredibly robust discussion forum, Lugnet.com, an inventory system that enables users to find out every part in a particular LEGO set, Pieron.com, and a virtual shopping mall where fans could open a storefront and sell individual elements, bricklink.com. The mistake many companies make when they first engage a community is to rush in and try to replace unofficial efforts with official efforts. Even if such a move is well-intentioned, it's as if the company is saying, "Your efforts are subpar. Let us professionals step in and show you how it's done." Not a very good way to start off the relationship. It also fails to appreciate the reality of the enormous amount of work it would take to replicate fan-based efforts. If LEGO had tried to create a replacement official photo sharing site to replace Brickshelf, we would have faced a monumental task. In addition to building an entirely new website at a significant cost, we would have taken months to even begin to scratch the surface of the quantity of images already posted to Brickshelf. Our task with these community projects was to embrace and help support them where possible. If these community sites needed financial support, we often gave it. If they needed our participation to gain legitimacy, we showed up. If they needed goodies for promotions that generated user engagement, we dropped things in the mail. The more we respected their efforts, the more they asked us to participate. And the more we participated in their community, the more interested they became in helping us with ours. We were learning about the fair exchange of value, a fundamental in community engagement. In time, this even helped me develop the mantra I use to this day: everybody goes home happy. 72. We like this marketplace much better. In fact, we are creating it. As I write this, Bricklink.com, the virtual shopping mall for fans to sell LEGO parts, sets, and collectibles among themselves, has more than 84 million items for sale from more than 3,000 storefronts. The owner of the site takes a 3% fee on each sale and is making enough money to live off site revenues. Many of the storefront owners are making a tidy living from the sale of individual LEGO elements, and the overall quality of model design has increased exponentially as parts have become easier to acquire. The brand promise I grew up with, "I can build anything I can imagine," has been elevated to a place that no one could have imagined in years past. And the evidence of this brand promise comes from the users themselves instead of marketing materials produced by the LEGO company. Fans have embraced the promise and made it even more real than it was when I was a kid. They've embodied the LEGO brand promise, something no company could make happen on its own. But this new marketplace wasn't taking away opportunity from the LEGO company, nor was its influence limited to adult fans. 80. Don't worry, you can still make money, that is, as long as it's not the only thing on your mind. In a few short years, LEGO had gone from almost never engaging adult fans to having them participate in the development of multiple product lines and concepts. The rest of the company thought the LEGO Direct team was crazy when we announced the launch of the $300, 3,000-piece LEGO Star Destroyer model, targeted to builders 16 years old and up. This was the largest, most expensive set in the company's history, and the most common reaction from our colleagues was, "You're insane." We had a hard time keeping them in stock. By the time the Star Destroyer model was released, we had a wealth of knowledge collected primarily from two sources. The first source was our initial and ongoing experimentation with product releases. In the earliest days of LEGO Direct, we had been releasing fan-friendly set designs. They started out much smaller and less expensively, but with each new set we released, we learned about what kinds of things excited fans of all ages. Second, we were consuming feedback as fast as we could. We were reading countless forum posts, having conversations with both individuals and user groups, and were asking product questions to any fan who would stand still long enough. By the time we produced the Star Destroyer, we had a firm understanding of how to excite and deliver. LEGO's entire product line has grown for the better, with sets for all ages going back to the basics of what has excited people of all ages for decades: fantastic models, creative ideas, and a brand promise that helps inspire kids to let their imaginations loose. Today, consumers can buy individual LEGO elements in any quantity they want. They can design their own models with the free LEGO Designer software, upload the models to LEGO.com, and have the pieces for those models shipped to their house in a custom box. And in 2009, 10 years after the Clue Train was first tacked to the Internet, children, parents, and fans will be able to experience LEGO in a way never before realized, a massive multiplayer online game called LEGO Universe. In 2000, the authors of Clue Train published those immortal words, "Markets are conversations." The Lego Company is an organization that took those words to heart. While I have moved on, I can still see the spirit of engagement, of conversation, living on in the product and in the enthusiasm that spills out from fans and parents and kids alike. One day soon, I hope to be sitting on the floor in front of a big pile of bricks with my daughter. Maybe she'll tell me that she has a great idea for Lego, and I'll be able to tell her that she can tell them about it, knowing that they'll be listening. Clue Train in the Cubicle by J.P. Rangaswamy. The Clue Train Manifesto, could it be 10 years already? Everything seems faster nowadays, probably something they put in the water. When I was asked if I would contribute something for Clue Train's 10th anniversary edition, the first thing I did was to try and remember where it all started. And as with so many things in those days, it began with Rage Boy. I was an avid reader of Entropy Gradient Reversals, as in the email newsletter of the time, and I think that's where he mentioned what was happening with the manifesto. The website turned into a book, one thing led to another, and before I could say Rick Levine, I'd met the other three authors in different places at different times. In fact, I still have a triple signed copy of the book waiting for Rick's John Hancock. Rick, you have been warned. Where was I? Oh yes, Bangalore. Yes, that's where I first met any of the Clue Train 4. We managed to convince Rage Boy to come over and speak at one of our development off-sites soon after the book was published. Suffice it to say, it was an unusual experience hearing Chris Locke speak, trying to get people at work to buy into what Clue Train stands for. Now, 10 years on, what impact has Clue Train had on people at work? Have things really changed? If so, how? If not, why not? I think we need to bear in mind that Clue Train was written in heady times of rapid growth and rapid change. Today, the world looks a lot different as we make our way through the detritus of a major global recession. On second thought, we don't have to bear that in mind. It is of no consequence except as a historical fact. Because, if anything, Clue Train is more true today than it has ever been. Why? To me, Clue Train is about many things, 95 things, in fact. But more than anything else, it is about 5 things. 1. It is a philosophy, a set of values, a mindset in which people rediscover their humanity. 2. It is about the way people engage with their customers. 3. It is about the way people engage with their colleagues. 4. It is about the way people engage with people. 5. It is about the changes that take place as people begin to engage with people again, as markets become conversations again. Peter Drucker once said, quote, "Most of what we call management consists of making it difficult for people to get their work done," unquote. And I think that's the heart of the problem. Ronald Coase's 1937 theory of the firm was all about reducing transaction costs, taking out friction. What Drucker saw was the very opposite. Organizations were QWERTYing themselves, slowing themselves up by design, and calling it management. Clue Train pointed out why this was happening. We were building walls between us and our customers, building walls even between us and our colleagues. Then we made it worse by using the most stilted and artificial modes of communication possible, and in the process we were dehumanizing ourselves, our customers, our processes, our communications, everything. To my way of thinking, it was all because of two popular ideas, the economics of scarcity and the assembly line. The economics of scarcity is, to all intents and purposes, basic economics to most people. Value is based on scarcity, and so scarcity itself is valued. If things are not scarce, then they should be made scarce, artificially if required. Which leads to quotas and barriers and hoarding and butter mountains, and you can imagine what else. The assembly line is all about division of labor, specialization, and reduction of standard deviation. When you put the two together, what happens is that you no longer remember that, to quote another Druckerism, people make shoes, not money. It is said that every economic era is characterized by a set of abundances and a set of scarcities. Firms that can take advantage of the abundances as well as the scarcities are bound to succeed. The trouble is, we've forgotten how to deal with abundance, and our natural response is to create artificial scarcities. Hierarchies are about boundaries, about scarcities. Networks are about abundances, about relationships. and everything is about people who are naturally more inclined toward network and relationship rather than hierarchy and boundary. Cloutrain was trying to point out that hyperlinks subvert hierarchies. Quote, "We are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers. We are human beings, and our reach exceeds your grasp. Deal with it." Unquote. Let's see how we've fared over the past decade. Let's start with how we deal with the customer. Finally, it looks like we've stopped referring to customers as numbers, as customer relationship management systems have come of age. In general, we now refer to people by their names rather than their account numbers. This is a good thing. But, as we've gotten rid of one evil, we appear to have created another. We now have systems that target the customer, that acquire the customer. Systems that call themselves customer relationship management systems, although no customer has access to them. Maybe we should call them by their rightful name, customer exploitation management systems, and be done with it. There is a better answer, vendor relationship management, the corollary to customer relationship management, and it's coming. Not surprisingly, it's coming out of the Cloutrain stable. For far too long, customers have been treated like slaves in this context, targeted and acquired. Their freedom has been made artificially scarce as firms seek to raise switching costs and migration paths through fair means as well as foul. But the news is not all bad. Data portability is becoming something that customers understand the need for, and as a result, firms are having to respond. Being treated as human beings, names rather than numbers. With customer data beginning to be recognized as belonging to the customer, how did that happen? With customers having more and more freedom to switch from one source to another as services commoditize, as healthy competition emerges, as the markets mature. 10 years on, the customer is not doing that badly. What about the walls within the firms? Are hierarchies disappearing? I think so, driven by three almost independent factors. 1. Generation M's entry into the workplace, the advent of mobile, multimedia, multitasking youth. 2. The inversion of the technology adoption curve. Nowadays, these kids try out new technologies far earlier than their predecessors did. 3. The growth of social media, software, and networks. You see, we could do things like insist on people using company PCs or phones, but that's a bit like telling people to restrict themselves to using company pens. It won't wash anymore. People have finally figured out that the letter P in PC stands for personal. When the youth of today stroll into work, their laptops and phones are theirs, reservoirs of their digital assets, their communications tools, their entertainment devices. Oh yes, and somewhere along the line, they're also their PCs and phones. We've tried telling them that our desktops and environments are locked down, that they must conform to the way we work, or go somewhere else. And guess what? They're going somewhere else. As long as there's a war for talent, we need to understand how to tackle this, and artificial scarcity is not the way. Much of what we call privacy and confidentiality and security is actually artificial scarcity, doomed to fail. There is only one way to keep a secret: tell no one. As against this, the internet is a great big copy machine, as Kevin Kelly reminds us. What happens when you connect something to the internet? It becomes easier to make copies of things that are connected to the network in the first place. So people figured that out and tried to make it harder and harder to make the copies. This attempt at artificial scarcity was met by equal and opposite forces of artificial abundance and therefore failed. That's what social media is doing, breaking up the artificial scarcities that have corrupted organizations. The concept of embargo, a critical component of old journalism, is a classic example of an artificial scarcity. Soon it won't be possible to have one. Of course, the immune system of the enterprise fights back, tries all the standard lies. It's too expensive, it's too insecure, it's a waste of time. But soon the lies are shown for what they are, lies. Social software tends to have very low implementation costs as software per se. The cost, and the value, is in the way people use the software, what they contribute, what they share. When we introduced social software at one of the firms I worked for, it wasn't long before I got a classic email, quote, "You have been encouraging your department to blog. I have been analyzing the blog posts of one of your subordinates. I notice that of the last 50 posts he has made, 47 have nothing whatsoever to do with work. 2 are possibly related, and only 1 is clearly and undeniably to do with work, unquote. I resisted the temptation to write back. Instead, I went up to the person and said, I'm delighted that you had the time to analyze my colleague's posts. Could you please compare and contrast the conversations you overhear at the water coolers and at the washrooms on a similar basis? I am sure the output will be as useful. Which reminds me, one of the ways we used to become subhuman at work is by writing memos. Instead of talking to each other, we would write notes, even if the person we were writing to was a few desks away. If anything, email exacerbated this. Social software is bringing the balance back. Not everyone understands this. There are many places where people think that blog posts should be treated as press releases, with workflow for approval prior to publication, which just goes to show the extent of the education needed. All in all, the advent of the new generation, coupled with the tools and technologies at its disposal, means that companies are less likely to be able to operate on a command and control basis. Evidence of true empowerment of the individual within the firm is still limited. By this time, 10 years after Clutrain, I would have expected to see many of the day-to-day decisions taken at work to be devolved. This isn't happening. There are a number of reasons, in particular, information asymmetry, another example of artificial scarcity. People seek to obtain power by holding on to the information required to make decisions. Tools to support emergent behavior are still somewhat immature. We don't see prediction markets used widely within enterprises. Even simple wiki cultures are slow to embed themselves. Why is this? It's because people are incentivized not to share information. We speak a lot about collaboration tools and techniques. We speak a lot about knowledge management. We speak even more about collaboration. But in the main, this is not what happens within the enterprise. When I worked in an investment bank, for example, it was nigh on impossible to get investment bankers to part with their little black book of contact names and addresses. It was their identity, the basis of their worth to the firm. And as long as it's what they believe, nothing will change. All this goes beyond the incentivization problem. The very nature of the firm is changing. Firms used to be about siloed businesses and products and services set in hierarchies with locked-in customers. Now, as Venkat, a friend who's a professor at Boston University, is wont to point out, firms are collections of open relationships and capabilities. Firms used to be about access to capital, about global reach, about benefits. Now most people have better credit ratings than their employers, and benefits have become corporate millstones. I think there are two other forces of significance that have been acting on the decade that's passed, forces that have been paving the way for Clutrain in the cubicle. The first is the customer's need for simplicity and convenience, as people begin to value their time more and more. This leads to a demand for self-service, which in turn puts the customer in control. Self-service paradigms are absolutely critical to Clutrain, something I've understood more over the years in conversation with the authors. Do-it-yourself is a good thing for the customer. There is no artificial scarcity in DIY. The second is the growth of open, multi-sided platforms in business based on deeper understanding of what Doc Searles terms the because effect. When something is scarce, you make money with it. The scarcity has a market value. When something is abundant, you make money because of it, not with it. Google and Amazon both make money because of Linux, not with Linux. In summary, the walls are coming down. As things commoditize and as the because effect rattles through industry, customers are finding their own voice again. Since all this is happening when members of a new generation are entering work, and since they have tools that are more collaborative than those of their predecessors, the scene is set fair for Clutrain to enter the cubicle. And particularly, since all this is happening when we're in the trough of a deep recession worldwide, it becomes even more interesting. Clutrain is about human beings connecting with each other in human ways, and it's what we need for the problems we face, not just at work, but around us as well. So I'm optimistic. Clutrain will enter the cubicle, and we will learn to be connected, not channeled. This has been the Clutrain Manifesto 10th Anniversary Edition, written by Rick Levine, Christopher Locke, Doc Searles, and David Weinberger. narrated by Brian A. Morris. Copyright 2000, 2001, 2009 by Frederick Levine, Christopher Locke, David Searles, and David Weinberger.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.